The subject is Robert Frost's poetry, and I want to pass around a very few copies that I have of a couple of poems that are not in the book that I'm going to recommend to you in just a minute, but they're by no means essential to have before you. There are a few people who are going to be using some of this material in future, so I can make available some other copies to you. But as you know, at Holden Village, we don't like to use a lot of paper. So it wasn't as though I could go down and make 100 copies and have everybody happy. So let me just pass a few of these around. If the one thing I'll ask you is that you share them, and by no means are they essential. So I just bring a few to each session, particularly for people who want them to follow. The book that I am recommending to you is the one that's available in the bookstore. I'm Tom O'Connell, by the way. I should say Tom O'Connell. I wrote it up here. I'm not Robert Frost. If you can't expect me Robert Frost, I'm very sorry. Robert Frost is no longer with us, but here's a good picture of him on this book, which is available in the bookstore. I recommend it to you. It's fairly reasonable at $5, $4.95 to be precise. I shopped and found the least expensive one I could find because I know that students are always poor. So I'm assuming that everybody here is a poor student. So this is the least expensive one that you're going to find, except that we happen to have in the Holden bookstore a lovely little volume that was printed right up here in Holden Village. For an event that I'm not sure about, but it was obviously made up special here, and it has seven poems, which are lovely. It's a lovely selection and comments particularly related to God and God's relationship with us all, as perceived through Robert Frost poetry. So I recommend this to you. This is 50 cents, the least, the most impoverished student can usually afford 50 cents, I find. So I recommend this to you. We'll be going through these, most of them, and particularly if I get requests. There are some of them that I had planned to go through anyway. This book that I'm recommending particularly, that I'll be speaking mostly from, unless you have requests which are not included herein, are edited by Louis Untermeyer, who was a close friend of Robert Frost's and his best editor, I think. This is a book, picture if you will, which is in the same format, exactly the same artwork, exactly the same printing, that I used in a book which I got in 1951. And I don't know what this cost, but I also have another book that I subsequently got, which cost, are you ready? 75 cents. So I think this one must have been 50. This one must have been 50. So now we still consider it a good price at $4.95, and that says something about something that Robert Frost would have been able to comment on very well, I'm sure. But it's the same, it's precisely the same book. Mine are all marked up, so I haven't got one of these marked up, but I recommend them to you, and I'll just hang on to it to recommend to each group as we come together, because it's wonderful, not just the poems themselves, but good introductions, brief, to the point, and perceptive, by Louis Untermeyer. A good poet himself, and a good friend of Frost throughout most of the lifetime of both men. So, we'll be talking today about his humor. I also have here, let me just mention mechanical items. I also have here a couple of columns. Again, I didn't make a lot of copies because of the Holden Village attitude toward making millions of copies and using a whole bunch of paper. We ought to be able to get along without it. But I wrote a column for our local newspaper in just outside Seattle in Washington for about 5 years. And I did one on Robert Frost. And I brought a couple of copies of these. If anybody wants them, you can pick them up after the class. Again, I didn't bring a lot, but and again, I'd like to ask you to share them if you would. And you might indeed read them and give them back so we can share them with other people, unless you're particularly interested. Finally, I should mention that I got to the library just ahead of Verlon, our village pastor. You got to be very quick around here to get ahead of Verlon. I'm not sure you've all sensed that, but it's true. And did check out of the library the collected poems, complete and unabridged, of Robert Frost. This was, by the way, edited by a good friend of mine who was at Dartmouth College with me, was the class behind me at Dartmouth. There are plenty more seats in here if you want to come in. Plenty right around here. Just come on in behind me, and this is all very informal, please. Don't want to have anybody left out because it's awkward to enter, because we've got lots of seats in here. This is the complete poem. So if, as I hope will transpire, some of you have some requests that we share some of the poems which are not in the anthologies, because after all, he wrote a lot more poems than are in Altemeyer's very brief anthology, or even that added to the very brief selection that I have made. So we may have some requests, and we'll be able to use this to find them. And I have a favorite one that I haven't happened to bring a copy on, so I have it. So Verlon, that's why I aced you out. You're welcome to borrow it, bro, if you want, at any point, right? Because there are wonderful poems in here too that I hope we'll have time to share. If not today, then on some of the other days that some of you will be able to make it for. So today we're going to talk about his humor. I've got a plan in mind for talking about his humor, talking about how he worked as an artist, as a poet, talking about his nature poems, talking about some of his most ambiguous poetry. There's a relationship between Frost poetry and ambiguity that I want to play with a little bit. And then some poems which have to do with Stoicism, all very neatly cataloged, right? Very tidy. And it doesn't really work at all. It doesn't really work at all, because Frost is not so neatly categorizable. He was a person who wrote poems that could be cataloged as humor, but they also are poems that have to do with Stoicism, or have to do with love, or have to do with ambiguous aspects of life and our relationship to each other and our relationship to God. So, in spite of my cataloging, I want us to feel free to break those bonds and talk about some of the other categories as well. But I did want to start off with humor, because his use of humor is particularly fun, I think. Yeah. And by the way, I'm always glad to have a chance to share his poetry, because I was lucky enough to know him. I knew him, I would say, fairly well as a very junior person working at Dartmouth College, which is the college that he first tried out. He was at Dartmouth for 7 months and left. And he always kidded Dartmouth people about the fact that he really got everything that was to be got, that it took us 4 years to get. He got it in a very brief time. But I knew him and admired him a great deal. And so it's kind of fun to talk about him, and as it seems appropriate, I will talk about my association with him, my friendship. I like to think of it as being with him when he came to Dartmouth College. A number of times I served as his guide. At that time I was assistant to the president at Dartmouth, and the president, whose name was John Sloan Dickey, knew that I was a great admirer of Frost, that I had majored in American literature, and so he gave me this assignment, which I considered a great plum. And you may be sure I was very conscientious and tried very hard to get along very well with Robert Frost, which I found very easy to do, although everybody didn't find it easy to do. And I had a great time escorting him around the campus, seeing to his every need, and most beneficial of all to me as a very junior guy, I had the responsibility for paying him after his lectures at Dartmouth College. That meant that he always looked very favorably on me. I was always a person that he related to, because after he gave his poetry reading on three different occasions, I was the person who took him to where he was going after the lecture and very politically and unobtrusively presented him with his check from the college. So we had a great relationship. If you ever have a choice, that's a very good relationship to have with somebody. I recommend it to you. His poetry is full of humor. Indeed, there is, sometimes I think that it's almost a paradox to talk about poetry and humor because they have an element that's central to each of them. What would you think that would be, by the way? Let's just stop for a minute and see if we can think of what would be the element that humor and poetry have in common.
Surprise?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. It's surprise. If you think of the funniest joke or story that you have heard in the last 6 months, just see if you can recall one that was particularly delightful to you that you've tried to share with others, or if you're not a joke teller, which you've just enjoyed on your own. If you each think of that story, I think you'll agree with me that the essence of your delight in it is that the punchline was surprising. That character in your story wasn't expected to say that. It was a little kid, perhaps, who made an observation that was extremely mature, so mature as to be fun. That's, of course, the essence of all of Charlie Brown's funny sayings, right? It's always, he's always in a situation of a little kid, but he's always acting like a grown-up. He's always making a comment that you and I would be proud to be perceptive enough to observe. So the essence of humor is that it takes us aback because we didn't expect that particular development to take place. And that's the essence of poetry as well, that the poet has managed to say things that we never expected to be put in those particular terms. And it's just delightful to see the poet's mind at work making an observation, making a comparison often, a metaphor, using a comparison of two things that we would never have thought were alike. They seem to be disparate, but Frost finds a way of bringing them together in just the right way, and that's what any poet does. Indeed, you could say the essence of poetry is metaphor. And then you could say that the essence of metaphor maybe is surprise, because it's making comparisons with things that, if we hadn't thought, we wouldn't be able to perceive as being alike. Indeed, there's a school of thought that of all the developments that made human beings distinct, there are lots of different theories about what was the one thing that made us distinct from all of the species, awareness of God being, of course, one. But there are those who think that perceiving metaphor, comparing two unlike things, unlike in most respects, perceiving those comparisons, those likenesses, was really what made the difference between us and any other kind of creatures. So talking about humor for Frost is in a way kind of redundant. It's kind of an oxymoron to talk about humorous poetry. Because taken from a certain perspective, you can take almost any one of Frost's poems and say it's humorous because it strikes us as so surprising that it delights us and may make us laugh when it's not really a funny subject, simply because we're so tickled by this comparison. But his humor is not obvious. His humor doesn't hit us over the head, not at all. His humor was very Yankee. Although he was born in San Francisco, his mother was from New England and her folks were from New England, Lowell, Massachusetts to be specific at the time that he was a little kid. His father was from the South, the US, and indeed he's named, as I think some of you probably know, Robert Lee Frost, for Robert E. Lee. His father fought in the Confederacy and was a very militarily oriented person, a very tough guy. Perceived himself, as many ex-fighters in wars perceive themselves as being. Indeed, it was very unfortunate the degree to which he was that way. But Frost spent most of his formative years in New England and became a very New England kind of person. And later, when he developed a persona, there are plenty more seats over here, by the way. Feel free to just come on over. Don't be inhibited at all. No inhibitions in here. One thing we don't have in here is inhibitions. Not at all. So his humor was the kind of Yankee humor that some of you, I'm sure, have shared when you've been in New England. It's not so different from a kind of rural humor that I hear in Washington State, around here, that you would hear. It's understatement. It's kind of, often it has a bit of irony in it. Often it has a kind of reticence, a taciturnity. For example, one of the remarks that I've often thought of as wonderful for Frost, although I didn't get it from Frost, but it strikes me as perfect for Frost, was an exchange that I once heard of two old men making, one to the other, about a third party who was a friend of both of theirs, whose name was John. And it's a perfect, very, very succinct Robert Frostian anecdote, because what the man said to his friend was, "John's dead. He died yesterday. He didn't want much said about it." That's all he said. "John's dead. He died yesterday. He didn't want much said about it." Self-effacing to the point of being kind of absurd. If you ever want to have attention paid, I suppose you want to have attention paid that you have moved on, that you have gone back, that you have been called back, or that you're no longer around. But not John. John was a real New Englander. Another New England exchange that always makes me think of Frost, although again I didn't get this from him, I heard this when I was working at Dartmouth, a fellow told it about an old Vermonter just across the river from New Hampshire into Vermont, who was up on a roof, fixing his roof, and a neighbor came by, and the neighbor who told the story said, it was a perfectly gorgeous New England day, sort of the way it is out here now. And it wasn't always that way in New England, as it hasn't been that way around here for a long time. And so the man shouted up to his friend who was working on his roof, "What an everlasting lovely day!" And the neighbor looked up at the blue sky, the golden day, and he looked back down at his neighbor and he said, "Hey, I, we'll catch hell for this." That's Frost's humor. There was one story that a friend of mine at Dartmouth told me about Frost, which is kind of along this New England line. He said that he, this very senior friend of mine on the faculty, and two other faculty members, along with Robert Frost, who was a member of the faculty at Dartmouth at the time, were going to a conference over in Vermont, across the Connecticut River and into Vermont, an academic conference, and as they drove, the five of them in the vehicle, they had to cross some back roads, and they came upon one really back road, which was a dirt road, and they found themselves behind a wagon going out to the fields carting a load of fertilizer, manure. So they of course had to go at the horse's pace, no way to go around. So they sat there, these five elderly gentlemen, trying to think of things to say. After a while, it became a little hard. And then the dean of the old faculty types at Dartmouth, who was a chemist named L.B. Richardson, trying to think of something graceful to say, said, "You know, gentlemen, it's rather interesting to speculate with all the erudition in this vehicle, all the degrees, the learning, the knowledge, the wisdom, the monetary value in this vehicle is probably exceeded by the monetary value in the vehicle in front of us." And Robert Frost said, "Give us time, LB, Give us time. A wonderful kind of frosty perception. And I just want to make one other observation about his humor, which is outside of his poetry. These are good stories about Frost. And this was a story that was told by my boss to me. My boss, as I mentioned, the president of Dartmouth College, was named John Sloan Dickey. And he was very proud of that name because he was the nephew of John Sloan, the great American late 19th century, early 20th century painter, so the dean of the Ashcan School of Painting, if you're interested in American art. John Sloan, on this occasion, was extremely ill. And John Dickey was down in New York, and he happened to be with Frost, and he was going to visit Sloan. Sloan was clearly on his deathbed, a very senior man. So John Sloan Dickey told Robert Frost, who was a close friend of his, I'm going to the hospital, is it, when I leave you to visit my uncle, who is, as you may know, Robert, extremely, extremely ill indeed. We're disappointed, but reconciled to the fact that he won't come out of the hospital, and he knows that. Frost said, may I come along, John? Well, Dickey was very surprised at this because Sloan and Frost were not friends. They had met just one time, as far as I had been able to ascertain. I was interested in that as a result of this story, so I looked it up, and they met once, but it was just they were at the same dinner party. So they weren't friends, and it wasn't a typical thing for a person to do, to say, may I go along? So Dickey said he was fascinated by the occasion and was wondering what Frost would say. What would Frost say coming into the hospital room with a man he really didn't know who was on his deathbed? What would Frost say? So he went into the room and there was Sloan there, and he's perfectly alert but aware that he doesn't have many days to live. And Dickey said, Uncle John, you remember Robert Frost? And Sloan was able to kind of nod. And Dickey looked at Frost to see what Frost would say. And Frost said, I have come to admire. That's all he said. I have come to admire. I think that's just a wonderful example of knowing what to say. So brief. But Frost admired Sloan's painting, as anybody who knows American painting would expect. So for him to say, I have come to admire, it's poetry in the sense that it's so succinct, it has that economy that good poetry has, that Frost's poetry had. Let's take a look at some of the poems that I think might be kind of fun. And I repeat, it isn't by any means necessary for you to have these poems in front of you to enjoy them. But I think that there are a few copies that are around. This, the one that I want to start off with is the span of life on the first page of our handout here. The span of life. Just a two-line poem. Somebody have it? Want to read it? Somebody want to volunteer to read it for us? What's your...
Just the first two lines?
Just that's all there are.
Then what's the next thing? That starts with For Thee, O Lord.
It's the span of life. The span of life.
So just these
two lines. Yeah, just these two lines.
The old dog barks backward without getting up. I can remember when he was a pup.
Now why is that a poem? I'm going to repeat it for you, called The Span of Life. The old dog barks backward without getting up. I can remember when he was a pup. Why is that interesting, and what does it say to us? I want to give it to you one more time just so you can think about it a bit. The Span of Life. The old dog barks backward without getting up. I can remember when he was a pup. What's the difference between the two lines? For example, The old dog barks backward without getting up. I can remember when he was a pup. What's the difference?
Talking about the present and not about the past.
Yeah, one's about the present. What's the present situation?
That he's probably told the people.
Yeah, it's suggested by the language, isn't it? By the way the line goes. What were you going to say about it?
If you bark backwards, are you behaving like a pup? I mean, is he incontinent, this dog?
No, I don't think so. But he might be. He's old enough to be. But I see him facing away from the people who come into the room, and he just turns around to bark a greeting.
I see.
That's the way I see it. I mean, this is surmise on my part.
Well, that might have been true.
That's all right. I admire you for it. Yes?
Well, a puppy is frisky and would run around, especially people coming in when they're old and lazy. You don't care who's coming in.
Yeah, exactly right. And what about the line? What about the line describing the pup? What is it? How does it differ from the first line?
Well, it's a remembrance of the past.
Yeah?
It also moves a lot smoother.
Yeah, notice how smoothly it moves.
Mm-hmm. Smoothly, it's frisky.
It's frisky, but it's also got a rhythm to it, yeah. The way a puppy will have. Sure, it may be frisky, but it doesn't. It's like a dancer. It's never, the motions are never as awkward as they are with the first one. Isn't that really an awkward line? Let me just read it to you one more time. Mm-hmm. The old dog barks backward without getting up. It's a hard line to read, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Really, it's a hard line to read. I have to think about it when I'm reading because it's so awkward in its phraseology. The old dog barks backward without getting up. But that's the way the dog is, you know. Every move is kind of difficult and not very smooth. Whereas, I can remember when he was a pup. Indeed, I'm going to suggest that we say it. Would you repeat it after me, please, everybody? I can remember when he was a pup. Isn't that smooth? See? So the fun in the poem is the contrast between that old dog awkwardly sitting there looking around and barking a greeting. And so in just the two lines, you have the contrast between that poor old mutt, lovely old mutt that everybody's loved, who doesn't have very long, can't really handle things very well, and the young, gamboling, but very graceful little puppy moving around at a smooth, frisky pace. This is by way of emphasizing for you how subtle his humor is. I mean, this poem, I never can forget this poem. Really,
but there's another level in there too. The span of life is also the poet who has been there for the whole thing and will be there longer. To remember the pup, knows the old dog now, is going to live on.
Good for you. Good for you, yeah. See the levels? One reason why Frost is fun to teach, by the way, is that he is so accessible. I've taught poets who are much less accessible than Frost, and they're fun too, but you've got to overcome a difficulty at first. But here we have levels of this poem, which if you give it any tension at all, has a kind of appreciation, but then you can get levels of appreciation. The longer you live with the poem, the more you think about it, and the more you talk about it. I always find people saying things that I had never thought about these poems as we look at. Anybody else have any observations about this? Are there any others? Two lines. Okay, let's take a look at, let's look at the next one. Just two lines. Somebody want to read that? Somebody have it? Go ahead, would you read it? Thank you.
Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive the great one on me, the big one on me.
One more time, give it to me one more time, would you?
Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. That's better.
All right, did it nicely. Okay, what's the big joke?
My reading.
That's a dividend. We got that addition. What is the big joke? Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. What's God's joke on us, might we say?
Life.
Life itself. Life itself can be perceived of as a joke, right? If you've got a good outlook. It's, should be a lot of humor in life, and the whole business can be perceived as just a joke. What else? What else might be God's joke on us?
Not knowing that our life is unfolding for us from one minute to the next.
Not knowing, that's right. The unknowability of our lives, right. The unknowability about what else?
Death.
Not knowing about the event of death and not knowing that vexingly, perplexingly difficult question, what lies beyond? What lies beyond for all of us? What lies beyond for me? You know, as I think about my death, I think, hey, is there really something there? I assume there is. As a Christian, I assume there is. But what? Thoughts about what could be the big joke? Well, those are two interesting ideas. There are probably others that may occur. What is the joke that Frost is referring to? Yes?
Well, this poem could be so individualized because we mentioned two things, but different people in different lives could have 100.
Exactly.
Different jokes, and as they read the poem, could cause a little inner smile depending on their life.
Yeah, exactly.
It's written so general, but it could be so specific.
Good. Right. There's one other on this handout that I'd like to have us read that I enjoy, which is over on page 2. Not all there. Somebody want to share Not All There with us? Want to read it for us? I'd like to have this participation. Want to read it for us? Okay.
I turned to speak to God about the world's despair, but to make bad manners worse, I found God wasn't there. God turned to speak to me, don't anybody laugh. God found I wasn't there, at least not over half.
Let me try it one more time. That was nice reading. Just so we can savor it a little bit. I turned to speak to God about the world's despair, but to make bad matters worse, I found God wasn't there. God turned to speak to me. Don't anybody laugh. God found I wasn't there. At least, not over half. What's working here? What does he mean, do you think, at least not over half? And here again, it's subject to a lot of different interpretations, which is part of the fun.
But you're a realist.
He's a realist. In what sense is he a realist?
Well, there's just too much truth in it.
Yeah, but God, I'm just trying to follow your line of reasoning. God found I wasn't there. Oh, you mean that he realizes he's only half there in the sense of being a half-wit?
Yes.
Yeah, and a manifestation of his own humility, right. Yeah, that's... Anybody else? Roland, what do you think about that? I turn to you for spiritual matters. What does this man mean when he says at least not over half?
Well, that half the time he just wasn't around for God. He either wasn't interested or, you know, he was thinking about... Maybe he wasn't even believing God at the time.
So yeah. Yeah, I think that certainly is one interpretation. If God turned to talk to you, do you think you'd be in a state of grace, ready to receive him in every respect? Or might you start to think, oh, I wish I hadn't had that last piece of apple pie last night because my sin happens to be gluttony? Shh, nobody knows but me, but he knows. Or whatever, fill in the blanks. Would you really be ready? Or would you be willing to accept him? You don't know what form he would appear in, I don't think. Most of us don't know. If you know, tell me, will you? We don't really know for sure. We worship and we make certain assumptions, but are we sure just the way God will appear?
think something interesting.
Please, and then next.
Two, just that he brings up world's despair. I think most of the time we try to avoid it whenever possible. And I'm sure God sees it all the time. And since we're trying to avoid it, we aren't there very much. And even if we're in the midst of it, I think we do our best to get out of any kind of despairing situation.
Yeah, but he's also taking a kind of a mild and gentle shot at God, isn't he? By saying, I want to talk to God about the world's despair, and of course he's got to be concerned about it, so I'm sure he would listen, be there waiting for me to give him my observations about the world's despair. But no, he's not. How can that be? That makes it worse. I turn to him and say, God, you know about the poor people, people who don't have enough to eat? Where is he? I don't find him there. I'm making a prayer, but we've all had the experience, I think, of praying and just not having it work. Just somehow you don't feel you're communicating with God. Yes, what you
were saying. The poems can often be moments when things are more centered than they would be ordinarily, and it's a moment when he's forgiving of the universe he doesn't understand.
Yeah.
Good nature and forgiveness.
Yeah.
For the moment.
Yeah, good.
I think our mind wanders when God is trying to talk to us.
Yeah.
So then you're only half there.
I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
Let's see, how long did Eucharist last night? About an hour and 25 minutes, I think.
Right.
I was there most of the time. But there were some times when I wasn't. I was there when Verlon was talking. Don't misunderstand me.
What did he say?
He told us about the old days in Kansas City. I always wasn't when Verlon tells us that. I wonder if I lived here at the Village, though, if I would ever catch Verlon repeating himself. I've never heard him repeat himself and tell about something that happened in Kansas City when he was a kid. It's repetition. I wouldn't blame him if he did. Right? But other observations about this one? Yes.
Well, I think that you have to look at it with both sections too, because if, I think kind of what he's trying to say is that unless we're ready and willing to accept God at all times, then God isn't going to listen to us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the degree that we don't pay attention, that we're not there for him, to use Verlon's good metaphor, we're not there for God. If we're not there for God, then I think most of us would feel, in that measure, we're not worthy. Because the holiest people that I know, the people who are most, in my view, close to God, are people who, most of the time, they're there anyway. And I know I'm not. So that's an expression of diffidence, I'm sure, appropriate. By the way, I'd be glad to have anybody upstairs making any comments here, and I don't mean to shut you off just because I'm looking down here. Yes?
I was just going to say, I think in that instance, we ask God for things. We want an instant answer. If we don't hear him instantly, we don't listen to him or wait to hear him speak to us later, I mean, in his time.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, we're not willing to wait.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing a sign in a wall in an office one time that said, "Lord, give me patience, and I want it right now."
Yeah.
R-A-T, now. Lord, give me patience, and I want it right now. Yeah, we're not patient. We're not willing to wait until he gives his response. He's got his own timetable, and it isn't necessarily our 50-minute timetable that we all are under if we're in academia.
Is there any expression of selfishness in this? I turn to speak to God. There's almost an expression of the ego coming out there that, I want God to hear me.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. He's got another poem that we'll come to that's nicely treated in the... did I pass out the book that's for sale? Where did I put that? Here it is. No, here it is. It's in here that we'll... maybe discuss a little about the use of I. Use of I. Yeah, very good. Yeah, I think, indeed, I read the line, "Don't anybody laugh," as being, he's been arrogant right from the outset, I think. I turned to speak to God about the world's despair. I was going to tell him what I think about it, and I was pretty sure he was going to want to listen, because usually when I speak, people pay attention. And they darn well better. But I turned to speak to him and he wasn't there. And then he says, God turned to speak to me. That's even more arrogant. And then he says, don't anybody laugh. Which, it strikes me, cuts both ways. That don't anybody laugh is to the line back of it, which is God turned to speak to me. What an arrogant thing to say. But then the subsequent line is also pretty arrogant. God found I wasn't there. At least not over half. So yeah, well, the whole concept of a personal God is perceived by some people who don't share the view as being selfish and arrogant. Who am I to think that God should pay attention to me? There is a degree of arrogance in that. You can see that point of view. I'm always sympathetic with that point of view. A personal God, people who aren't Christians would say, you think that God should pay attention to you, that Jesus Christ should pay attention to you. Well, that's, why should he pay attention to you? All the billions of people in the world, all the other creatures, etc., why should he pay attention to you? So you're right on. That's a good observation. Okay, let's see what else we... what I want to do, I want to be sure that I do this. I want to ask if there are ones that you would like us to share, particularly if you've got some that are favorites of yours, and especially if you happen not to be a person who's going to be able to be with us on subsequent days, because I hope some of you will be able to come to subsequent sessions. Tomorrow we're going to talk about some other humorous poems and talk a bit about how he worked, start to introduce how he worked. But I know that some people are not going to be able to be with us in subsequent sessions. So particularly in their cases, I want to be sure we get out some of the poems that you would like to have us. So are there ones either in the book that some of you have, I know, or on the handout that you'd like to have us read, or should I just go ahead with taking us through some of the rest of these? Okay, I'd like to refer to one that is in the book, which is a considerable speck is on page 255 in the book. Does somebody have the book who would like to share that with us? 255. Want to try?
The whole thing?
Sure. Sure. Just take your time with it. And I appreciate that you haven't had a chance to preview it, but just go through it and see how it comes out.
A considerable speck. A speck that would have been beneath my sight on any but a paper sheet so white, set off across what I had written there. And I had idly poised my pen in air to stop it with a period of ink, when something strange about it made me think. This was no dust speck by my breathing blown, but unmistakably a living mite with inclinations it could call its own. It paused as with suspicion of my pen, and then came racing wildly on again to where my manuscript was not yet dry, then paused again, and either drank or smelt with loathing, for again it turned to fly. Plainly with an intelligence I dealt. It seemed too tiny to have room for feet, yet must have had a set of them complete to express how much it didn't want to die. It ran with terror and with cunning crept. It faltered. I could see it hesitate. Then in the middle of the open sheet, cowered down in desperation to accept whatever I accorded it of fate. I have none of the tenderer than thou collectivistic regimenting love with which the modern world is being swept. But this poor microscopic item now, since it was nothing I knew evil of, I let it lie there till I hope it slept. I have a mind myself and recognize mind when I meet with it in any guise. No one can know how glad I am to find on any sheet the least display of mind.
So now this is not as brief as some of the others, but he builds, it seems to me, so beautifully to that last line. We've got to know this little mite on this piece of paper by his bringing us into the scene, you and I, the readers, we are part of this little adventure, of this little creature scuttling across his piece of paper, and therefore we are taken with the interplay between them. And when we find one of the bases for Frost's restraint in this event, that most pieces of paper that he deals with don't have much mind displayed. And this little creature is displaying mind. It's just a wonderful little conceit on his part to share that with us. But in doing that, he has taken us through a lot of adventures, even though it's such a simple little event in one perspective. Observations about it? Questions about it? Yes?
Just the last line struck me that maybe the mite is a symbol of his poem, that he's the last line, I don't remember it, but...
Let me read those last four lines, if I may. I have a mind myself and recognize mind when I meet with it in any guise. No one can know how glad I am to find on any sheet the least display of mind.
I'm so glad to find on any sheet the least display of mind. It's kind of a little, that's very humorous. It makes me think of, how many sheets do you read that have no mind on them?
Yeah.
Like, no written thinkingness. And like whether it's a poem or a written anything by anyone or himself, that it has some mind in it.
I think you've got what he's after. It hit you where he wanted to hit you. Yeah.
I believe that instead of that, I believe that he's using the sheet of paper and the mite as metaphors to people. He's glad to find, a person with a mind that he doesn't want it wasted, because there isn't many.
There you are. Yeah. Human or otherwise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I think that's right.
So there's some arrogance again a little bit on his part.
Oh, yes. He was a very arrogant man. Very arrogant man. A very arrogant, difficult man whose ego was such that he had a lot of enemies, and I know some of them. For example, his view was belligerently anti-science. And on the faculty, as he was at Dartmouth, there were, of course, lots of scientists. He alienated them all, who would no longer discuss with him any matter on which there was a question of the value of scientific inquiry. His poems are full of references to, of a very arrogant nature, some anti-science. I spent the morning looking through this, refreshing myself with lots of the poems that I hadn't had contact with for some time, and I was struck again with how arrogant towards science he was. It's fun. Science has so much power these days that it's kind of fun for us humanists to read a fellow humanist taking a shot at him, right? It's kind of fun. And yet, he was so strong in his rejection of science and the value of science. And the worthwhileness of what science has accomplished, that he, James Bryant Conant was one, for example, not a man I knew, but a man that you probably have heard about, who was a chemist, a distinguished chemist, who was the president of Harvard University for years and was commissioner of Germany right after World War II, a man of enormous sophistication and balance to see humanistic values as well as science, the need for science and the worthwhileness of science. He and Frost were just not able to talk. So he was indeed, you see a lot of the arrogance in here. There's indeed a phenomenon that I think we ought to pay attention to him, and that is a kind of, and I talk about this a little bit in this column, the degree to which the persona that he projects, the Robert Frost that most of us know, is a kind of persona that he built very carefully of the Santa Claus, old New England Yankee, benevolent, sweet-natured, painting pictures about the way New England life was, which are somewhat saccharine, somewhat oversweet in their presentation. And yet, on the other side of his person was an extremely egotistical, ambitious, ruthlessly ambitious man who wanted his name to echo, as indeed it has echoed throughout the world, and who would achieve that at enormous costs to his family, for example, to his friends. Out of it comes, though, out of it comes a work, his poems, his poetry, which is worth it. Well, who's to say? Who's to say? It's hard to know whether we would justify it. His life was a tragic one. His family was in terrible straits through much of the growing up years, many of the growing up years of his kids. He lost 3 of his kids while he was alive, one of them by suicide. It was his only son. And to give you a capsule of what he went through, picture if you will, his son's last words to him before his son committed suicide were, "You always have to win an argument, don't you?" Can you imagine living with that? And yet, he had so much knowledge of the way the world is and put it into accessible form for you and me that you say, well, maybe that's the way an artist has to be. Maybe an artist has to devote his or her life to the art, and if there is family, the family has to suffer. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know whether it's worthwhile or not. Well, I want to be sure that I not hold you beyond our agreed upon hour, and I think we should probably break up very quickly, but I want to be sure that if there are other observations about any of the poems or any requests for poems that you'd like to have a share in future, I'll be sure to kind of dig them out. Yes?
Did you write anything about his son's last words, or did that begin?
He wrote letters. His letters are wonderful, and if those of you who are admirers of his poetry, and I hope there will be some who maybe come out of these sessions, I recommend to you a collection of his letters edited by Lawrence Thompson, which is full of wonderfully sensitive observations about all this. He was a man who knew himself. He knew his own faults, and he wrote wonderful letters which had a lot of the arrogance taken out of them, because they were to close, very close friends, and to family members. His letters to his kids are wonderful, because he had these two sides. But essentially, Verlaine, your very good question is with respect to his poetry, must be that he didn't write very directly about things, and yet the learning that came out of the experiences that he had with his kids and with his wife were essentially in the poetry, but not explicitly so. It's not explicitly there. His wife, by the way, was not a believer at all. And when we come to talking more about his faith and his attitude toward God, there was a lifelong conflict between him and his wife on this front. She was herself a very pessimistic woman. And the trials and tribulations that they had with their kids made her a cynical, pessimistic person more than most people you and I have known. He, on the other hand, retained a kind of faith which came in large measure out of his mother's faith. His mother was a believer in Swedenborg teachings and taught him the importance of faith, of belief, which he carried all his life. Although he was very unsympathetic with any particular sect, and would, in his own tough way, make comments about faith as a very ritualized exercise. In spite of all that, though, there was a faith that he carried all his life. And their conflict was a very real one, as we'll see with some of his other poems. So I'll close now so we don't miss any of the next events, including supper, obviously. That would be a sin too terrible to be...